welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here for episode 193 and part one of my conversation with longtime Concordia College of Minnesota percussion professor David Eiler. Well, it's been another eventful week, folks. Around the School of Music at Mizzou, we're taking stock of what we can do to improve the lives and experiences of Black, Indigenous, and people of color in our students, faculty, and staff through right now lots of discussions and meetings with all entities. And it's part of this odd time where we're managing the coronavirus and how to get back a recession and how to get back from that, and what should be, at this point, pent-up anger at structural embedded racism in this country. Speaking of which, this past Sunday, I ended up attending my first Black Lives Matter rally. Columbia, Missouri had a very large rally that ended up having somewhere over 1,000 attendees that appeared to be racially representative of the population in Columbia. I felt compelled to go, and I'm glad I did. It was all of the things that you should be hearing about when you attend these rallies. Angry, peaceful, emotional, difficult, all of those things. But most importantly, as I said, peaceful. I'll have more to say about it in the rave following the interview. Now, let's get to this week's guest, David Eiler. David and I met years ago as he was one of the first folks to be in regular attendance at the National Conference on Percussion Pedagogy, or NCPP. A conference that I mention here regularly on the show because I got to know many of my guests there, and it was the event that was, along with other duties, the main part of my graduate assistantship at UNCG, was running NCPP. David Eiler has quite a story, particularly of his time getting settled into the job at Concordia in Moorhead, Minnesota, as well as teaching at Minnesota Moorhead and North Dakota State University all at the same time for a long period of time. This time also includes his path on making the Concordia job his only job there. It's a tale of endurance, hard work, and a battle to stay healthy in difficult times. We'll have more about David next week in part two, but for now we'll talk to David about his work, the coronavirus, and have a slight overview of his career. So let's get started. We recorded this interview over Skype on May 27th, 2020, and it begins right now. All right, so David, give me a summation of your percussion responsibilities as they are right now.
All right. Well, I'm at least at one school now, whereas my first 15 years here, I had three schools, three separate responsibilities. So pretty much three areas I teach. Of course, the private lessons, all the private studio.
And the school is, just so people know.
It's four-year undergraduate, yes. So just a liberal arts college. Started about 3,000 when I came, and now we're in the 2,000 range. And, of course, who knows for this coming year. We're hoping that most of the students come back, but depending on the news in the next month or two and see where we're at, you know, with all the things going on in the world and then the reports over the last few days, the weekends, and watching, you think, wow, this is the end of May. And really this started, you know, on like the 30th or 31st of December. So this is all still pretty new. It's less than 5 months old, but we're anticipating students coming back at least the start of the school year. So private lessons and then percussion ensemble. Which I have two. There's the large percussion ensemble, and then we have a separate mallet group. So I call it the marimba choir. That's another story because, you know, Concordia being, I don't want to say it's a choral school, but noted for their choirs. And then the third area I do is the percussion methods class. So in the past, you know, I had quite a few students, and I've had some overload. So I've had an adjunct that has taught the methods class before. And then financially, the school, you know, students pay for their lessons, their private lessons, so it was more feasible for them to have somebody hired adjunct to teach lessons rather than the methods class, which in my tier of things, of course, students come to study with me, hopefully, and do percussion. Ensemble experience is great. The methods class, I don't want to put it in that third tier, but yet, you know, that's the general music education major that somebody with, you know, some knowledge can teach. And, you know, I started that when I was a grad student, and you know, I liked it, but that's kind of the third on my list.
All right, so let's back up. When you start teaching there, where are you at before then? What was the kind of the situation? Like you said, you had two other schools that you were also kind of working with. So what was the kind of the situation when you got started?
Yeah, well, I don't want to say it was a mess, but they could never keep a percussion teacher for longer than 3 years. 3 years was the max. Actually, Andy Spencer was two before me. Andy is at, you know, Central Michigan, and was the percussion and the dean for a while, and now just teaching percussion. But he was the longest term for 3 years, and then most were 1 and maybe 2 year position because there were three schools that you were required to teach at. So basically, it was called a tri-college position because there's three schools. So Concordia always had the largest music department, which is where I'm at now, and Morehead State University, which changed their name later to Minnesota State University, Morehead. They had the whole system a few years back changed. That was 30% of the load, and then NDSU was the other 30%, North Dakota State University. So it was 40, 30, 30. And then even my first year at Concordia, I bypassed the 40% part of that load and went up to 78%. And I was there for a couple of years. And then I kept climbing and got over 100% just at Concordia. I was teaching full time. So 40% was the load that was given that I was paid for. And then 60% was an overload. So responsibilities were lessons, of course, at all three schools. There's one ensemble. So it was called the Tri-College Percussion Ensemble, which we had students from all three schools kind of come to. Concordia was a central place that had the most extensive inventory where we could put everybody in a rehearsal room and then do our once a week rehearsal for 3 hours, which we're still doing.
Wow.
Halfway through the first year, you know, a lot of the kids were really good mallet players, and they wanted to do kind of a separate, smaller group. So I said, well, let's do a marimba group, because coming from the schools where I was at, we can talk about that later, being at Ohio State and LSU, I was doing the mallet ensemble. And then knowing about the tradition, just being here for a few weeks, about Concordian choirs, we got the group together. We had 8 people the first year, and I came up with a name called the Marimba Choir. And the whole thing was to try to get people to come to a concert because it had the name choir in it, and not knowing what to expect, you know, and introduce them to the marimba. And it kind of worked out real well. We had about 75 people the first concert, and people would come in, what is this marimba choir? And we didn't even have students hand out programs. My wife was one of the ushers, so she would say, oh, just, you don't like it, sit down, and, you know, it's a very pleasing sound. And they kind of fell in love with the sound of the marimba, so they would come back. And, of course, then I put the marimba choir with the percussion ensemble. I was supposed to kind of do sectionals at all three schools, like with the band and orchestra. That was minimal, but it was kind of expected. And then marching band at NDSU. The only one of the three schools with marching was North Dakota State. Of course, at that time, well, even now, it's Division II school, but they were, you know, number one ranked, and actually won so many national championships on that level. I think last year it was like fourth or fifth in a row or something, and even back in the 1980s, they were pretty strong in that conference. So that was 3 days a week. So my movement around campus, depending on the semester, and actually at that time when I started, only one school, Concordia, was on semesters. The other two were on quarter systems.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I would start earlier in this year for, you know, two schools and then go later with another school, and, you know, breaks never lined up. So once I started, you know, near the end of August, it was straight through until almost end of May before I finished out, except for Christmas and Thanksgiving, of course, the break.
But those breaks would be shorter, I would assume, for different schools.
They didn't have the, you know, 1 week fall break or anything. It was like 2 days here plus a weekend, and then a week later it might be 2 days at another school. But there were times that I actually traveled, you know, at different schools 4 to 6 times a day. So I may start at Morehead State in the morning, teach a couple lessons. I'd come over to Concordia and do the methods class, which was 4 days a week at that time, you know, in the early afternoon. Teach a couple lessons, go to marching band at NDSU, come back to Concordia for percussion ensemble. The next day might be an entirely different schedule, start at NDSU, go somewhere else, and then end back to marching band. And my rehearsals were in the evening, so I was doing that. Plus symphony, you know, was always, it's a community orchestra, you know, regional community, but, you know, pretty good for the players that we have, the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony. So, you know, the schedule was kind of unique, and of course I learned the first year to keep record of all my travels because, you know, my wife was pretty good on the taxes. We did our own taxes, and she's kind of the mathematical mind of the two of us, you know, except for budgets, you know, with me, she keeps record. So, you know, we actually, you know, it's kind of a different sideline here. We were audited three times. We were cleared all three times. Mm-hmm. IRS never trusted us for record keeping, but, you know, we'd go in with that stack of materials. And, of course, I would buy instruments. I found, you know, most of the instruments in my studio are personally owned. I have a few marimbas, you know, quite a few actually, and only one I ever purchased new, so they were always used. But I bought them for the program, and I kept records, but the IRS would never trust us that we were doing the right thing, so I kept records, and, you know, it was actually about 2 to 3 hour waste of their time, you know, and mine, but, you know, we were always cleared. But after the third time, we thought it's time to get somebody else to officially sign that document and do the taxes, and that was like 15 years ago, and never looked back. You never had a problem since.
Yeah.
You know, when a CPA signs the form, it's like, okay, I guess they're official, but, you know, people can't do their own taxes. Yeah. So anyway, that was the program for 15 years. And I got pretty experienced doing interviews because, you know, all three administrators, well, of course, I was kind of under the realm of 10 people. So I had three different chairs of the music departments, three deans that were in charge of the program, the presidents who were basically signed off, three presidents. And then we have something called the Tri-College University. There's a provost. So he or she, and for me it was a he each year, would then do the final numbers there. But they all said basically, well, we know you're not going to stay here because nobody's ever stayed longer than 3 years. So it was a yearly contract, and that's why I just lived in an apartment for all those times. I couldn't even think about trying to buy a house when I might not have a job the next year. But the program grew, and I would apply for positions. And luckily for me, the former vice president, dean at Moorhead State University, got the job at Concordia when it came open. And she was one of our biggest promoters. She would attend the percussion ensemble concert. So I knew she knew about the program and knew about me, so I put her at the top of my reference list. So that was the last 2 years kind of interesting and quite good because there was a year, oh, I don't remember, 15 to 20 years ago, where there was like 8 percussion openings in one spring. I mean, that's never happened that I remember. Percussion and other things, but I got several interviews, and she was always getting the call that semester. And as a matter of fact, she called me on a Friday afternoon and knew that I was getting ready to go for an interview. I'm not sure how she found that out, but she said, you know, come and talk to me before you make any decisions. I understand you're making a little trip, but we want to see what we can do to keep you here. So that was the kind of the change. That was back in 2001. And so that was, you know, worked out for me. And then basically Concordia hired me full time. And then they had people that were at the other two schools. So Kenyon Williams, you probably know, he did the Moorhead State job, and then he brought his world music experience there in steel drums. And then Sigurd Johnson, he was hired to do the athletic band and percussion. And he was at a smaller school about an hour away called Valley City State University, and actually a Concordia grad, so he was here for his undergraduate degree and then went to Memphis and got his doctorate. And, so that's kind of how that evolved. And then once I was at Concordia, life was a little bit easier, a little better. And the pay, of course, went up considerably, considering that the Tri-College, all three schools, I was paid on the North Dakota pay scale, which for the country was among the lowest. So, you know, each of the three schools contributed to one check, but it was through NDSU, so it was better financially for all of them to do it that way. Benefits were good, but, you know, salary was not the greatest. But what I would say to young people, you know, I was kind of getting started, is it wasn't about the money. It was about the experience and teaching and building a program and just having fun doing percussion, which I did. And it's another reason my wife and I never had children, because I've never had time to do anything else. I was always days and evenings and weekends at one of the three schools, just doing percussion, repair, maintenance, or teaching. Or besides the three schools, I had a private studio of about 1 to 2 dozen high school students. So that was mostly all day Saturday and Sunday afternoons.
Wow. First of all, when you get hired, is it what's the designation of the position for, you know, that they use or that you were being called for those while you were doing the three schools?
Well, the title was Tri-College Percussionist.
Okay.
So that was the official name. And, you know, the description wasn't real extensive. It basically said kind of what I mentioned, you know, two private lessons at all three schools, percussion methods class, a direct percussion ensemble. And there may have been a reference to, I'm sure I have it in the files. I kind of save everything. I'm a pack rat. Sure. That was 30 plus years ago, and there probably was mentioned the marching band. But I kind of knew what it, you know, had, what the expectations were. There was another job open at kind of the same time, and I was a finalist for that position. But their decision wasn't made until 2 weeks after they wanted the job here to be secured. So, you know, the bird in the hand versus, so when they called me up after my visit, and I was at LSU at the time in Baton Rouge, and it was like, we really need a decision soon, you know, can you get back to us like tomorrow? I was like, so I went with it, and I think it's turned out pretty good, but I really wanted the other job, which was in Tennessee.
When you get the job, are you aware of the fact that, how soon do you find out that this has been a position that just they can't keep anybody? And I guess it becomes pretty obvious why that is.
Well, yeah. And they even told me in the job, you know, or in the interview, if you get the job, we understand you're probably not going to be here that long. We just want somebody to, you know, like yourself, get some experience. Even though I thought I had pretty much experience, it wasn't, you know, full-time teaching at one school, because I came pretty much right out of grad school. I was a band director, so I used my education part of my degree, and I taught in Baton Rouge. I actually did the whole ball of wax. I started at the high school level and went backwards. I did high school, junior high, and then elementary band next year. So I had that experience. I was TA, you know, at two major universities. So, you know, I had that experience, but not full-time. So they thought, you know, I was not going to be around that long. And then 1 year led to the next, to the next. But interesting, on the one full day, you know, I had breakfast with one of the chairs from one school and a band director. At lunch was with another chair and their band director. And then dinner was with a separate one. So they kind of passed me off. So I got a chance to ask a lot of questions and hear about the program. And they were fair, you know, above board, telling me what they expected and what they probably were not going to be able to get out of me. And I just basically tried to be, you know, a full-time good faculty colleague at all three schools, which was real difficult because I even tried to attend all the faculty meetings, and sometimes it worked and other times it just didn't go with the class schedule. But I showed up as much as I could.
Okay. So when you get there, because you have three schools, then you have, I assume, three different inventories.
Yes.
To deal with, right? So how are you managing that part?
Oh boy. Long, hard discussion.
Sure, yeah, I bet.
You know, I was here in June, so it's the 1st of June for my interview. And then to try to wrap things up, and my wife, she's music also. She was a band director in Baton Rouge. And just trying to wrap up that situation and get here. We didn't get here till August, and about the second week in August. Marching band at NDSU didn't have a camp as such, but it was a couple days before school started. But, you know, I would go visit the schools and start making a list, first asking about inventories. There was just such a changeover in the teachers that there wasn't an ongoing list. The records, I mean, there was some at each school, but, you know, most lists hadn't been updated in many years. And, you know, one of them, the band director did it, another one, the chair did it. And so I started making my list. But the instruments at NDSU, getting ready for marching, I mean, it took like a whole week every day, just 8 hours a day. Can we buy some drum heads? We need to replace this. And my wife and I, God bless her, we were, you know, NDSU just trying to get the drums ready for marching. Concordia was probably the best of the situations. It wasn't an extensive inventory, but the instruments were in pretty good shape. And then Morehead State had an entirely different, matter of fact, that's where I did my interview and my recital. I had to put together a marimba before I could play my recital. It was in pieces on the floor. They only had two. And, of course, you know, one thing I learned from that, and I should have known, I prepared a piece for basically 4.5 to 5 octave marimba. The largest was a M250. So it was a 1/3. So I had to do some adjustments and leave off. It was a box, leave off the low G's. But, you know, the thing, it was pretty sad. So, I had to piece together the marimba. I had to find instruments and put together a snare drum stand to work, you know. And that's a whole other discussion as far as, you know, auditioning and what kind of pieces to pick. Timpani, you know, not knowing, you know, of course, I knew about that. Pedals, you know, don't pick a piece that a lot of pedaling. And I'm not sure. I mean, I've done a few auditions like the orchestral guys. How you show up using somebody else's drums when you're trying to play Bartok and not comfortable with the ranges and the feel of the pedal, you do the best you can. But it took a long time for inventory to kind of get it settled. And the person here before me, I mean, was doing rehearsals at one school and they'd move instruments to another. So there were pieces from one school at another school. And it took a while just to get things categorized. Okay, this is Concordia's, this is Morehead State, this is NDSU, let's get it in the right place.
Wow.
Then I started making my lists and saying, okay, what do we need? And of course, not knowing anything about the ensemble, where we were going to practice. And then the couple students that I'd met early on, well, we did most of our practice at Concordia because they had two marimbas at that time. Well, two and a half, one barely playable. They would actually bring an instrument from NDSU and Morehead State to Concordia for rehearsal and then take it back afterwards, basically an M250 marimba. So it's been steady for actually 30 plus years, just building the inventory. And I'm pretty comfortable now. I mean, over the years, I can say, you know, with my instruments and working deals with our various chairs, and my whole thing is when I leave, whenever that is, next year or the year after or 10 years from now, I want the person to be able to come in and feel like they're set, ready to go, and they don't have to go buy this or buy that. You know, we have a fair amount of 5-octave marimbas. We have more vibraphones than most schools I know. We finally got our first 4-octave vibe last year. So we're set with a 4 and a 3.5, and we've got about 4 xylophones and 4 or 5 Glocks and a number of drum sets, not all great, but, instruments. I think we still want that one really, another top line set of timpani. You know, our best, our Adams Duff Philharmonics are in the orchestra room. But the band director likes those too. So, you know, when it comes close to a concert, okay, we'll move the Adams over there and take the Ludwigs and change them. And luckily in my studio, you know, you see a little bit behind me, I have some Ludwig timpani in the back and my 5-octave here. So I don't have to borrow the school instruments to actually teach my lessons. So it's just been a slow, steady gain, you know, trying to keep the inventory going. And some of my colleagues, you know, maybe are not as appreciative. They don't understand, you know, as much about percussion and the needs. And when you have an ensemble of 12, 15, 18 players, you need the instruments. And I've supplemented that enough with my own personal instruments, especially keyboards. So a few years back, a few years meaning 10 or more, I said, it's time for the school to step up and start buying these. And because someday I'm not going to be here. And the instruments that I own are probably not going to stay here unless there's some fantastic deal that the college works out with me.
So those are still the ones you're talking about are still yours. Like you haven't bought something and then had the school buy it.
I have not donated it, no, to the school. Okay. It's in my collection. So, in a few years, you'll see a major, whatever, Facebook post or something, inventory, big, massive sale.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not trying to, you know, make money on it. I keep telling my wife, you know, again, between male and female, I'm probably the first one to go. I said, this is her retirement, you know, learn how to use eBay or whatever, you know, at that time. So, you know, when I start selling instruments, I mean, I'm going to keep certain ones. I mean, I love my 5-octave. You know, I have a Marimba one that's great. But my favorite, and the students, I think their favorite too, is my Corey. I have the 4.5 Corey model 1200. That I got years ago. That's just one of my favorite marimbas. Matter of fact, I don't know if you ever met Steve Beck. Steve Beck was the PAS executive director for years. And after that, he was Pearl. He was moved to the Pearl Corporation and had some medical issues 10 years ago or so. And he was a student with Johnny Lane at Eastern Illinois and owned this Corey. And we were talking at one of the PAS conventions. I had known him as a high school student. So when I was at Ohio State, he came to marimba camp. We used to have a summer marimba camp. And so I started a relationship then, and he told me about his quarry that he was thinking of selling because he wanted to buy something smaller, like an M250 that you take apart and put into the car. The quarry's a little bit big. So I talked to him at the convention in November, and by that Christmas, we had talked several times. I went to the school, Eastern Illinois, and picked up that marimba on the way back, and I was a second or third year into my tenure here, not making a lot of money. He was able or agreed to basically let me pay like half of it down payment and give him a monthly check for a couple of years just to pay off the marimba. But it was just one of the best quarries that I've ever heard, and found out that he actually worked for Corey one summer, and he actually got to select this marimba. There was about five that came in, and it was his favorite. So kind of a hand-selected marimba.
Yeah. That's great. That, when I was at UNCG, that was the best four and a third was a quarry. And so before we got five octave marimbas, when we moved into our new built facility, that was the prime instrument was the quarry used for most of the recitals. It was like the one whose low A hadn't been broken by playing the Rosario First Concerto, basically.
Right. Or the low C on the Minky, you know.
The time, yeah. Yes, yeah.
That's one reason I'm very hesitant for students to play, especially an aggressive student.
Yeah. I think I've kiddingly called that piece for crack C3 because that's everyone did. I think Julia Gaines would point, when she would have a student who wanted to play, she's like, I'm just going to have to buy one right now, buy a C3 just to have.
Extras on hand.
Exactly.
Just like when I saw Keiko several times on tour when she was in the U.S. And, you know, she, of course, the Yamaha with the 6100.
Right.
But she traveled with an extra set of bars.
Yeah.
She became just in case, you know. And yeah. That was a great haul down at UNCG. I remember being there in the early days of NCPP.
Yeah.
When Court, you know, they just had the new percussion room and great recital hall.
Yeah. No, it's great to be there when I was all brand spanking new and everything. I can tell you that. So what is the distance between all these schools? So how much driving were you doing a day typically, or what was the accumulation of that?
Okay. Well, per day, I tried to, when I was looking for places to stay, of course I wasn't thinking about a house, you know, we bought an apartment, but there's an interstate, you know, with two systems, you know, the north and south is I-29 and east and west is 94. Mm-hmm. So we had a place that was just off of I-94, about less than a mile, an apartment, and I could hop on 94 and be at Concordia in 3.5 miles, which was less than 10 minutes. Morehead State's another mile from here, so 4.5 miles. It's basically, we have one street, and then it's across the graveyard. There's a cemetery there. So it's actually 9/10 of a mile. So for my IRS, I always put 1 mile because I didn't want to worry with 9/10. Matter of fact, that was one of the questions one of the analysts said. I said, well, you have to drive around the parking lot to find a place. So, I mean, it's 9/10 because she didn't believe it was a mile. And NDSU is 10 miles from here, and actually 9.9 or whatever, but I take the interstate, which I would go 94 across and 29 north. And I do that because I didn't want to drive through town because there's too many stoplights. Mm-hmm. And afternoon, I might finish the lessons at 3:30 or 4, and marching band was at 4:30, and I didn't want to be late. I wanted to be able to hop in the car, get on the interstate, and zoom up there and 10 miles be at the practice facility. So all told, it was about 5,000 to 7,000 miles in town, you know, per year, which totaled up, you know, for about 9 months. And you know, I found out that certain things you could do or couldn't do, like our symphony practices were also at Concordia. So if I was at NDSU for marching band and came to direct, you know, to the symphony, I could count that for the IRS mileage. However, if you went home to eat dinner and then came back, that part would not count. So technically, you know, I would stop at McDonald's or something, but you know, mileage wise, that worked out. My wife and I are both from Baltimore, from Maryland. So that's the family mostly still lives there, those that are left. And in the summertime, we would travel there. It's just under 1,500 miles. So again, this is going off, you know, kind of the IRS, but the government gives you the opportunity. I would always take some repair work to do, like tuning of Marimba bars, and I'd stop off halfway through in Chicago and go to Century Mallet and deliver a set of bars or two to Gilberto, travel to the East Coast, you know, spend the weekend home visiting family. Of course, we were only an hour and 15 minutes from Steve Weiss Music. I'm not trying to get promotion for companies,
no, but no, that's it.
Steve and I had a great relationship. I knew him when I was a student. So I drive up there, spend the afternoon picking at music, picking sticks, mallets, pick a gong, whatever. But the gist of it, on the way back through Chicago, I pick up the bars that were done two weeks later. I could count that trip off with the IRS because it was business related. And even though I was visiting family, I still, the mileage counts, the hotels, the food, not for both my wife and I, but for myself. And all those things, see, the IRS didn't believe that, you know, we could keep those records, but we kept the records. And that was a fair chunk of change when it came to deductions.
Yeah.
The new tax laws are a little different, but it was at that time really good.
I mean, that's a lot of driving for just staying in town. I mean, yes. That doesn't even count if you're driving to like PASIC or some other meeting or like the state fest, state music fest, or right. You know, clinics. It's just that's just in the town that you work. So,
and of course, the challenge was in January and February and winter, because you know we do get snow occasionally.
Occasionally,
going from one place to the next, that was a chore. So you had to leave time in the schedule for those road conditions. Yeah. Another reason I don't like to go through town, too slippery and sliding and going right. through red lights.
Yeah, and I've heard it can get chilly at those times of year as well.
The first year here wasn't bad, and it was, I mean, it got below zero a few times. The second year, I couldn't believe it. It stayed below zero for 3 weeks straight. Even the daytime high didn't get above, you know, minus five. So, yeah, people were like, when is it going to turn something? It's just, so you might not get snow, but it's so cold. And, you know, people would go out and start their cars, you know, in the middle of the day, just make sure the batteries didn't die. So winter is not fun.
Yeah. But this time of year, probably pretty nice. I would.
Yeah, we have not had an 80 degree yet day. It might happen today or tomorrow, but it's been mid 70s, which is very nice.
Oh, that's great.
And low humidity.
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Totally the opposite of Louisiana. Boy, that was just hot.
I wanted to ask you about your work on dealing with storage, because I feel like you're as the best resource when you talk about all the storage things like at NCPP and the ways you kind of figured out how to label, so tell me a little bit about how you developed your program of storage.
Well, what's nice is the places I've been able to visit, you know, like when I was at UNCG and of course going to OU and to see what other people do. And just to kind of look around the building and see what spaces are available, because for all in percussion, we're always wanting more space. There's always places you need to put instruments. And I'm a person that I really am concerned about security. So I don't want to have a nice marimba sitting out in a rehearsal space, because it's not just band orchestra people that go through. And even in our area, there's kids that wander through the building at night. Even though there's college students around, they might go in and just take something and hit on the bar or something and crack it.
Right.
So I'm always kind of observing to see what spaces are either not being used or could be used differently. And my colleagues don't always like to hear that, but I found like now at Concordia, we had a space that was being used for the library, the band library. And there was another smaller space that I thought was, this is maybe 5 to 10 years ago, perfect for those cabinets that would fit, and we could use that for our keyboards, which later became our keyboard room. We got moved out of faculty offices as we've grown. We had three practice rooms right next to my studio. There's three percussion rooms, used to be. It went down to two because we had to give up one space to a band director. Then we hired somebody else, and our second choir director came into another space. That took another practice room. So, you know, the chair at that time says, you know, we need to take over your space. So you have, you know, one practice room in that hallway left, but you can use the faculty lounge. So we use the lounge for storage and practice in off hours, like in the evening. You know, students really wanted to use it more, and secretaries might go to lunch, they'd have that hour. But for meetings and just the space, it was not optimum. So that chair at the time said, you know, when we find another space, the first choice is going to be for percussion. So when I found out that we could reorganize the library and move to another space, that room became ours. There was another space in the band room that was used for basically storing old instruments that was not used or anything. And it's kind of under a stairwell, but, you know, it fit. Right now we have three marimbas and a vibraphone, a Glock, three file cabinets, and a drum set in that space that was basically used for nothing important at the time. Mm. So we took over that space. We have a basement practice room, but which also has a storage room next to it. And of course, the basement, you're not going to carry keyboards upstairs, but, you know, we have some multiple setups and some drums and whatnot that we can move to the basement. So it's just basically kind of analyzing the space that you have and seeing what's available in the building, maybe not being used, or that could be used differently. And then trying to get your faculty members, well, first persuading your chair, and then to him or her to help you persuade certain faculty to maybe give up their space or reuse it in a different format. So we've been able to work. And I don't think, you know, we're a little spread out. It's not like all one hallway. But, you know, again, with our inventory, it's close to 20 marimbas, probably 7, 8 vibraphones now, you know, 5 Glocks, 6 drum sets, 3 sets of timpani, you know, not even ones in my office. And they're spread out through the building, but they're almost all secure. I do have now in the two largest rehearsal rooms, we have a band room and an orchestra room. I have a Keylon marimba in one room and then an old marimba xylophone in another room. So it's a 4 octave. It's not one that everybody prefers to play on. The bars are kind of, the space is wide. And then we have 2 older vibraphones. So if somebody really, the practice rooms are taken up, they could go to the large room and practice those instruments. Just not going to have a 5 octave marimba sitting out there. So, yeah, it's always tricky, but always analyzing and seeing what can be used differently.
Well, and what you've talked about is not even all the snare drum stands, concert toms, like that was a, you know, that part you're also, I'm sure, having to figure out too.
Now there is, you know, there's the NCPP website does have, I think, my last session, which I have photos in there too. So I took some pictures. It goes on one wall in the band room. We have 3, 4, 5, 6 cabinets, built-in percussion cabinets that have the doors that swing open. Some have drawers pull out. So I have labels. You know, I keep the Office Max in, supplied with the labels. I have a label maker and make sure that everything is marked so the students know where the bass drum mallets are, where the gong mallets, where chime mallets are. And, you know, the tom-tom, so they're all locked up. But one thing that I found, I don't know how many years ago that was, for stands, I used the PVC pipe. So I used the 6-inch PVC pipe and just stack those in there in that space. And just, you know, each of the, I like the LP, the 332 percussion stand, has so many great uses to it. And we have probably a dozen of those. We just slide those in the little PVC pipe area. And then you lock the door, and the managers and the section leaders for each of the ensembles have the key. They have access. So before rehearsal, they'll open up the cabinets so the students can get out what they need.
So I understand where all the larger instruments. So what are you doing with this, you know, the tambourines or the concert toms, or what, how are you dealing with those smaller things?
Yep. So in our cabinets, you know, the ones with the drawers, they're smaller pull-out drawers. You know, that's where mallets would go.
Right.
Some of the other cabinets have like a large space on the bottom or some shelving. So the shelving would fit like concert toms. So we can fit actually in the one cabinet, all 8. We have 2 sets. So we have a nice Yamaha. You know, for years, we just had the one-headed toms. They're okay.
Yep.
But actually, OU, one of the concerts I went to at NCPP had Lance did, I forget what piece it was, but the concert toms were just beautiful. So I made note after that, and I told the band director, you got to get these Yamaha toms. And So we got a set of Yamahas and we got a set of Pearls 2 years later. But they all, you know, eight of them will fit in this one cabinet. And in this little mini storage room that I mentioned, we also have shelves in there. So what gets used the most in the band room is in those cabinets. If it's something that's a second or third tier instrument doesn't get used as much, it'll go to the storage room. Even for the complementary percussion, I like to use that term that Keith Alio, you know, kind of mentions in his clinics. Don't call them accessories anymore. We don't call them toys, you know. The complementary percussion, what's used most, the triangles, tambourines, castanets will be in the cabinets in the band room. Otherwise, it goes to the storage room. And then we have some shelving in there that, you know, the doors open up and there's small shelves. So, and the practice rooms, I put tambourines. We have like little shelves, like for bookshelves. So there's one in each of the practice rooms. So we'll have a tambourine or triangle kind of in there if somebody wants to practice that. Cymbals, once upon a time, I used to have a set of cymbals in each room, but we lost a pair. So I don't do that anymore.
Gotcha.
Don't have marching cymbals. They're all basically, of course, I'm a Sabian guy, so mostly 17 to 21 inch, you know, HH, very good quality concert cymbals.
Gotcha.
But students could have access if they want.
When you get to the point where you it becomes a full-time Concordia becomes, is that because, is that a combination of they see the work you've done and it seems right? Is this a, you leverage this? What, how does it end up happening that you could finally, like, you're killing, like, because I think at some point I had talked to you at an NCPP or you had talked about this in a session where you're like, you were, it was like I mean, it sounds like it was just physically, it was nearly killing you, right? Like, I mean, yeah. I don't want to be overly dramatic, but I mean, it sounded like it was getting to that point.
It was painful is what it was. And that's because after a couple of years, I developed an ulcer, a bleeding ulcer that I didn't know I had. So basically one spring, it was right towards the end of the semester. I mean, I had been having pains and of course I wasn't eating healthy. I didn't, you know, I had my coffee cup sitting over there. I, you know, drank coffee in the morning and coffee in the afternoon. I might grab a sandwich somewhere or wait till the end of the day. So I had an empty stomach that was being filled with coffee. And, you know, basically I was burning the candle at all three ends. And it just, I was feeling run down. And so anyway, this ulcer finally exploded, you know, at the beginning of the spring or the finals during that spring semester. So I ended up in the hospital for a week. And I was flat on my back. As a matter of fact, my colleagues, you know, actually taped juries. So they the videotape, you know, back. So this would have been like 15, 20 years ago. And I got a chance to lay there and do juries and evaluate, you know, the class final exam for a week in the hospital and said, you know, things need to change. And, of course, I keep records. I still have them in a file cabinet, the schedule every semester. And I would say by my fifth or sixth year, I was already teaching almost the full load just at Concordia, 100%. And then between Morehead State and NDSU, another full load. NDSU was always a little smaller, even though it was a bigger school music-wise. It was about 30 to 40% of a load. Morehead State was a little bigger, so it was about 60. So with the full-time, 100% at Concordia, 60, 40 at the other two schools, it was about a 200% teaching load. And the reason my wife and I never had children, you know, so people say, you have any children? I say, well, yeah, let's see, I've got about 45, 50 this semester. I had 60 last year. So no time for children, but I was run down. And the dean, when she took over the new job, and I put her on my reference list, understood why I was looking for other positions. And her whole thing is we need to, you know, make you, let you be a lot more healthy and get you one job. You know, would you be interested in just teaching at Concordia? Well, yeah, let me get back to you. Okay.
Let me check my yes. Let me check my
schedule. And to find out that finally I would get paid on the Minnesota pay scale, and my increase was substantial from where I was being at the bottom. I thought, yeah, it's time to make that change. Even though I hated to leave the students that I had. I had some good students at NDSU and MSU. But for my health, I just needed to to make a, and I'd seen all of my teachers along the way, you know, when I was at Frostburg State in Maryland and Ohio State, and Jim Moore was at the near the end of his career. But the amount of teaching that they did, and John Roush was my teacher at LSU, an amazing man. But he was also the associate dean, and just for assistant. They had a dean, associate, and assistant. Well, at least I think 25% or a third of his load was dean's office, and the rest was teaching, which was really great for me, both at LSU and Ohio State, because I got to direct percussion ensemble a lot more than your average TA would. Because the teachers just say, "Hey, you want to conduct another piece? Well, pick another piece. Yeah, I've got, you know, too busy here." And so I was conducting. I felt bad in a way at both schools more than half the program, but it was great for my experience. So yeah, it took a while to get things to work out, but that's why I applied for other positions. And not that I really wanted to leave, because every time I would get an offer or a certain dean, the dean at Concordia at that time was great. Before this one lady who eventually hired me, the first one, his hands were kind of tied. But when he knew that I was having an issue or had another offer, he would contact the other two deans at the other two schools and say, "We need to increase the salary for the next year for David Eiler. What can we do?" So he said, I'll get back to you the next day or two. And they would always come up with some type of increase to try to keep me for another year. You know, even if it's a couple thousand dollars, it was still, you know, something that made me feel a little bit more worthwhile. And then I must say that the dean after him, they kind of split it up, you know, and as they do once one person's doing too much, and then they rehire the position. So they had two deans then doing the work of the one dean. But, you know, I got a check like from Concordia one summer. Because one of the deans, well, his wife actually worked in one of the departments who was secretary, and knew that I was here doing maintenance and repair. And all of a sudden, it was like, this may never happen again. It's a one-time thing, but you know, here's an extra check as part of your salary this month for what we see that you're doing, you know, to help our students in our programs. Like, wow, somebody's noticing. So it made me feel a little more appreciated. And it did happen again a couple more times, not every year, but so like, okay, well, I'll go ahead and stay. And then, you know, just kept building the program. And then support with the instruments too really helped.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I'm wondering, when you still had the three positions, how were you doing recruiting? Like, I mean, if you were, or were like, were like, were, did you have high school students? You'd be like, I'm at any of these schools. You can, how were you, what were you, how were you managing that part?
That was very difficult. Yes. Because I was told, you know, repeatedly and exclusively that, you cannot recruit for one school. Okay. So, and I had a lot of high school students that would be studying with me. My studio at Concordia was still the best, you know, the largest, and I have instruments. So every Saturday or Sunday afternoon, they come here for a lesson. And, of course, Concordia is not as cheap as some places. You know, it's a fairly expensive private school. So all I could say is, you know, no matter which of the three schools you're going to go to, you study with me. The ensemble would be the same. You'd still be in the percussion ensemble. What I encourage them to do is go to the concerts, go hear the Concordia band, go hear the MSU band, go hear the NDSU band. You know, if you want to be marching band, there's only one choice. So you have to go to NDSU. They have the marching band, even though it's the smallest music department. You know, sit in on a couple classes, go, you know, try to get a theory class. And I had a couple students local that would do that. They spent more than one day and they would visit one school and visit another one and talk to some of the band directors. And, of course, I'd always feed the names to the, you know, various directors, especially the one at Concordia, because that seemed to be the most supportive for music. But I could not say you need to go to blank school. Which also made the same thing tricky is Minnesota Allstate is great. I don't know if you're familiar with what they do. They have, except for this year, a camp. So they do a summer Allstate camp. So the students in the Allstate band go to one school for a whole week, and they meet with their director, and they do a concert at the end of the week. They record it. Same thing for the orchestra and the choirs. They're all at separate schools, but they hire coaches. So they hire a coach for percussion, for, you know, the high winds, low winds. So there's about 15 different coaches that work all week with these students in sectionals and attend the rehearsals. And, you know, we do little percussion ensembles. But to me, that's a major recruiting thing, but you're not supposed to tell them about, you know, any, you can't recruit for your school. So, you know, I would do things like at the end, our first CD, you know, I'd give them a little gift at the end. Like, here's a CD, which, you know, the three schools wouldn't contribute to that. But when I got the position at Concordia, it would say Concordia Percussion Ensemble. So, you know, there are ways that you could do that. But in the early days, you know, it's like I teach at blank and blank and blank. So I couldn't say you need to go to blank school. But if you come to Fargo-Moorhead, you know, the little twin cities, we call it, you'd study with me no matter what. But most of the students would realize after attending the concerts and hearing the groups, there was a difference, noticeable difference. It's better now. But Concordia was one reason I stayed, beside the support that they gave me, especially with funding. It's a unique place, and music is an essential part of the college. I don't know how many faculty we have, 200 and some, but we have 46 in music. So wow. We're talking, you know, not all full-time, you know, with the adjuncts and whatnot. So, you know, when you're talking about a fourth of the college or music, you know, faculty, and I think when we had a couple years ago closer to 3,000 students, there was at one point 900 students taking part in music program and lessons and ensembles. That's like a third of the college.
Yeah.
So they're very supportive, and most of the students that were looking at schools could kind of see and hear the difference between the various groups. Percussion-wise, it's kind of unique now because, you know, both Sig Johnson and Kenyon Williams, they do slightly different things than I do. And I'm more of a, I don't call it traditionalist, but, you know, we do more basic percussion. You know, Kenyon's really into world music, and that's great. You know, I was trying to get a steel band, but just would never push it through. And then when, you know, and he, you know, had his band, that's fine. You know, we have a gamelan. We do have, you know, West African group. I have another student that, for a faculty member with a student assistant that does that. So it's a lot of stuff happening, but the students still are stretched real thin. You know, technically now we have three bands plus the athletic band playing the stands, you know, at the games. And we have two orchestras, three jazz bands. And I think all told in the instrumentals ensembles, close to 20. There's about 18 ensembles, including the chamber groups. So it's a good place for music, and the students that want to play, you know, in percussion ensemble, I would say not even half are majors, music majors. There are other majors. Matter of fact, I've got, you know, piano major. I've got two choral majors. I have last year, I think, three composition majors, which is great because we have people writing for us as well. So it makes it a very unique group. They're not all percussion music yet or performance majors.
What's been take me through what your school did and how they dealt with and have been dealing with the coronavirus situation.
Yeah. Boy, it was tricky. It happened so fast. And you know, we were given basically less than a week in that March timeframe. You know, we were given, I think you need to start thinking on Friday afternoon of canceling a lot of things that were upcoming. That would have been in March, middle of March, so like 13, 14, something. I had a student with his senior recital on that Saturday. We were going to come back, I think, Monday and Tuesday and have your final classes together, and then the students were required to leave campus by Wednesday at noon. Well, we also had a big orchestra concert. You know, we had three past guest conductors that were here on campus that came in. Started rehearsing Thursday, Friday. Saturday was to be the concert. The dean came down with canceling all events because I think the president or the Minnesota governor said no more gatherings of than 200 people or something. And so it was still early, but yet the concert that was scheduled for that afternoon, what they did, we did a recording session. So the orchestra recorded like at 11 a.m. and had some faculty and a few people there, maybe 15 to 20. Recorded and had some applause. I had a student with a 2 o'clock recital. Kind of a different story. I won't do the whole thing, but basically his parents had already come up. They were here Friday. Things were supposed to be canceled. the security cameras in our building noticed people coming into the building that weren't students and looked more like community members. So security called the dean, who called the chair, who called. So we had an impromptu session in my office here with the dean of the college and the head of security, and saying, what's going on? It looks like you're having recitals. Well, it's supposed to be a recital, but we're calling it a dress rehearsal. So I told the students, if you want to come to the dress rehearsal, well, we can't do that because now the distancing thing. So basically the parents that were here, I think we had 6 to 10. The dean agreed that we can let the immediate family who traveled come in the recital hall. They had to keep their distance. We have a computer lab. You can go to the computer lab, anybody else, and watch it. We have a classroom that has the large monitors so they could hook it up. So we had people throughout the building watching the recital, and just family members and myself. Anyway, it was the last recital of the semester that happened that Saturday. And then they had canceled the classes that were to be on Monday, Tuesday. But it was like, what can we do, you know, to get students off campus? So as soon as you can gather materials you need for the next few weeks, go home. And then they were supposed to come back the weekend or the week after Easter. So I think that Easter Tuesday, that was the first thought. So I'm thinking, okay, what can we do for online teaching for a few weeks? So I said, okay, my wife and I grabbed every tambourine we could find in the building, every triangle. I grabbed some music. I got a tambourine solo, something they could take a practice pad. If you don't have a pad, you know, if you grab this mallet, so we could do something online. And ensemble-wise, of course, we never did find out what we could do percussion ensemble-wise. But most of our lessons then online were, you know, triangle technique, tambourine techniques. We did the tambas, you know, Jim Moore solo, and we did some snare drums, so we concert rudimental things. We went through the Wilcoxon book, which, you know, some of the seniors hadn't done since they were freshmen, but I thought, you know, it's always good to review. You know, the review was great. Luckily, a couple students have keyboards at home, so, you know, two have a marimba. Those that were studying in spring semester, the freshmen study vibraphone. So what, you know, in my teaching, I have it set up 4-year plan. You know, we do marimba and snare in the fall, vibraphone and snare, the opposite in the spring, rudimental concert. We do timpani sophomore year, then we do multiple percussion, you know, we'll do then xylophone, and basically 3 years of different basic percussion. And we do master classes every other week on a Wednesday night for an hour and a half. So, and then the senior year, of course, getting ready for recital, doing that. So they didn't have a lot to take, but there were a few students that were able to stay on campus because you could do that if your home situation wasn't that you could go home. So we had two that would take like a vibraphone out of the building. So one took it to their dorm room and set up shop, you know, and another one took it home. So we were able to do some keyboard, you know, at home, but other students didn't have the space, or, you know, the parents were also working at home. So it was like, let's do a practice pad and a tambourine and do those. So the Zoom lessons kind of worked, you know, for that. The methods class was at first a real challenge. You know, we teach percussion methods every semester. The only modification I had to make that we could not do is our playing exam on keyboard, because they normally do a marimba solo and accompanied. So it's the two archaic dances, Armin Russell, and they play all that thing. And so I had to let that go. So we just did snare drum counted double for their playing exam. But the rest were, you know, online, and I was able to do, you know, demonstrations of things here in the office. And I learned a lot about Zoom. And after the first couple sessions, two students, I think, had come down with jobs since they were at home, and a lot of the teachers were not doing, let's say, classes on Zoom the way that others were, didn't meet. So anyway, some had a little more time on their hands, so took jobs, so they might not be able to do a methods class. That we did it, which was 120, you know, 4 days a week. So then I learned, oh, okay, I can record. And so I recorded a session on Zoom. And I'd set up, we did a Facebook page, you know, a group just for the methods class. We did another Facebook group for just the percussion ensemble. So every class that we would do, and I recorded it, then I would post that on the Facebook page so that everybody who missed the class could go back and watch it later. But I saved those big assignments that we could do kind of online for the end of the semester. Like I have a big budget assignment. We do that where the students have to do a budget for a middle school program for percussion. And that was a good discussion for 2 days, you know, Zoom. We did our percussion ensembles. We couldn't play together, but did some research, and I was able to learn how to do the shared screen. So, you know, went to the roll-off site and went to – I really like this tap space, the Beyond Basic Percussion, the two Brian Hicks. And it's a great little series of like 8 to 10 ensembles, perfect for that middle school, easy high school level. So we watched probably part of each of those. We did it, you know, online as a group. So we were able to do a lot, I think, as far as the methods goes. The tricky part was, like anything, is setting up Zoom with the device that they had at home versus mine. And of course, we're lucky, you know, school, we have, you know, we all have either iMacs or a PowerBook. You know, we're 99% Mac in the department. But then my wife and I had done enough testing, so she was at home, and I test your Zoom, and I figured out how to do this and that. And let's go into your audio settings. So the first master class, it was like, okay, everybody, let's, you know, go to this and click this, and then go to your advanced settings. And so we disabled the background, or disable this, or put this at certain percent. But, you know, it changed a little bit when they were at home, if they were using an iPhone, or other type of Android phone, or whether it was a computer, desktop, laptop. So once we finally got those, and it would be different if they were playing a practice pad. That's one thing. If they were playing a snare drum, that was entirely different. Those playing keyboard, you know, there was one that just had this feedback that was just something. So we had the space a little different. And finally, one young man, I think his mother set up a camera, or not the camera, but a computer in another part of the house. He had his device in the basement, so it was a three-way thing. So, you know, it was kind of recording where he was, but going through her computer in another office space, coming to mine. Well, we got it to work, but it took about 2 lessons to finally get that coordinated. So I think just the technology part was a little tricky at the beginning. I'm not an expert, but I know so much more about Zoom now than I did, you know, a couple months ago.
Yeah,
I was able to help a lot of faculty kind of figure it out too, especially like the brass people, because the feedback and stuff that they were getting. I said, well, let's check this setting and check that setting. But to be able to share my screen too in the class, that was great. And then try to figure out ways to make the master classes a little more interesting. You know, we had some guests come in, you know, kind of like, you know, I'm guest today. We had our last class, Gordon Stout was, he was going to be one of our artists for the Day of Percussion. That didn't happen the week before Easter. So he agreed to come into our last class and kept it a surprise to the students. But, you know, a few people played, and he was able to kind of have a little master class. Matter of fact, I had one working on the Mexican dances. So that was a kind of a surprise to him. So, well, you can't have anything better than the composer, you know, listening to you and talking about his piece.
Yeah. Except that he's been talking about it for, 45 years or whatever at this point. No, I hear you.
The lessons was the biggest challenge far as, well, of course, the ensembles. I still haven't figured out a way to have, you know, a group play together at the same time. And I know the band orchestra directors are thinking the same thing. They've all the researches and going to all the webinars from various companies about how to do it. I know one of the bands did an end of the semester piece, but each person recorded their part, and then they put it together. And he spent 12 to 15 hours of editing. And I said, boy, for a 3.5-minute piece, that's a lot of work.
What did your school do about access to the building?
The building was locked as soon as the students were to leave that Wednesday in March at noon. We've had a few people that had to return some things or whatever, so it's kind of a case-by-case basis. Last week was the first time the students were allowed back on campus, because, you know, when they left their dorms, they just left what they couldn't take.
Right.
So it was 8 days. They had, you know, Sunday through Monday, and they had arranged times, I guess, so that there wasn't a massive number of people on campus at one time. So I thought it was pretty well done. They were spaced out that you had a 4-hour window. So it's like 8 to noon and noon to 4 and 4 to 8. And then our our student union building was kind of a drop-off place. And in music, we had people at the table with the plexiglass and sign-up sheets. And, you know, you had tables where they would go in and drop off their practice pad or their this or that. And but students have not been allowed in the building. And faculty can come in. But luckily, there's only maybe 4 to 6 of us that come in to do work. And I don't know how I would have done lessons otherwise, other than being here, because everything's here in my office, the access. And somebody would be working on a piece, and I didn't have the music in my knowledge, so I'd run over to the file cabinet and pull it out. And we're right now anticipating coming back, you know, on campus, but in the fall, but just trying to figure out how to do it with our physical distancing.
Right.
They've been spacing out the large rehearsal rooms and figured out, you know, where the band would normally have 65, 40 people is kind of max. Orchestra is about the same. The choir people are thinking about sectionals, you know, doing, I think the one choir room, you can only put maybe 35 people in. The other room's large enough, maybe 50. And they put out chairs and, you know, director even did 7 feet apart. And so they're figuring out ways that we can make it work. Today was about, you know, hand sanitizers, and mine was moving instruments. And, you know, I sent out a note to my students last week, just kind of a, you know, not what if, but when you come back to campus, thinking positively, we have ensemble practice. And, of course, percussion, we're already kind of physical distancing anyway. With only thing that challenged for me is sometimes I'll double up on marimbas, you know, have 2 people on a keyboard, so. That we'll have to figure out something else. But what would make you comfortable? What should we think about with you coming back on campus? What kind of things do you see happening or would like to happen? And I've gotten a few good responses now. Of course, hand sanitizers, about touching the door handles, and you know, the face mask thing we can do unless you're playing a slide whistle or something. But so it remains to be seen what the CDC and what, you know, the governor, you know, says should happen, because right now, you know, the state is quote unquote open or opening up. But yet, you know, even churches, I think now are supposed to be still no more than 200 or something, and still with some distance with your family members. So, you know, concerts, we were talking about concerts, they might be just streamed without an audience, or maybe taping them. And then posting the date that they were normally going to happen, but without live audiences,
right?
At least for the fall. And our biggest challenge, I think, for Concordia is we have this big Christmas concert thing. I mean, every year the history is that's the moneymaker. You know, they put 20,000 people in these seats in one weekend, so it's a it's a huge event. And what they would do, you know. Taping it, or so that still remains to be seen. We're expecting some announcement by the administration the first week in June. So we heard a little bit from the dean, because we had a meeting, a couple of us with her the other day. And so they're hoping that people will come back in the fall as usual. And then looking at what others are doing, there's some, I think, Notre Dame and some other place, they were going to go up to Thanksgiving. And then do the rest of the semester online. So not having students go away and come back, shortening the fall break, or no break at all, or just a break on campus so that you're not leaving and going, you know, on a trip and then coming back. So, I mean, it's still new. I mean, it's like 5 months old, so less than 5 months.
Yeah.
You know, it was December 30th, I guess, was the date, I guess, that Wuhan was the first discovery. And, of course, they kept it under wraps there for almost a week. And January 21st, I guess, for the first U.S. Person to get the virus. So we're still trying to figure it out.
All right. So, David, let's back up. Where did you grow up?
All right. I'm an Easterner. Okay. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, or actually just Bel Air, Maryland, which is about 30 minutes north of Baltimore. Up the Beltway pretty quick. So I'm a Baltimorean or Baltimorean.
Did you have any family members in the arts?
My mother was a pretty good musician. She was a vocalist. And as a matter of fact, she started at Peabody. She was working there, Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, mm-hmm. and found out that she had an issue with her vocal cords and soprano straining, and was told she needed to stop singing or at least forceful, aggressive singing, because she had something that would maybe pop eventually and it would be disastrous to her health. So she liked singing, and she could play the piano and accordion. That was my first instrument. And then, got me to the love of music, of course. And I was a percussionist, but basically a drummer. And then she got me somehow in the last 2 years of high school hooked up with Peabody to audition for their preparatory school. So I was there on Saturday, basically, and sometimes on Sunday. Again, just a 45-minute trip into Baltimore. And it was really great because I got to see things and do things that would prepare me for college. And didn't know anything about being a music major because really I was an athlete. I was more into sports, which I loved. And, the three sports, since I played football, well, the real football, soccer. Couldn't do the American football because I was in marching band. So I did that. And then basketball, which is my true love. I loved that. Except found out I was too short eventually for that at 6'4". Guys were much better than I was. And then baseball, sideline. I mean, when I was north of Baltimore, there was a guy at school just down the street, Aberdeen, named Cal Ripken Jr. So we played him, played his team when I was in high school. But anyway, I found out I wasn't as good an athlete as I thought I was, but I like music. So I got to do the Peabody prep school, and I would just have private lessons. You're going to have a theory class, a basic music appreciation. There was an ensemble, both percussion ensemble in the afternoon and a contemporary ensemble of maybe 20 to 30 people, and brass and wind instruments. And then at the end of the day, you've done like 4 o'clock, so like 8:30 to 4, with brief time for lunch, and you can stay in practice. So I told Mom, don't pick me up till 6 or whatever, because I want to play on the marimba. Because at my high school, didn't have a marimba. We had xylophone bells and the chimes, but no marimba or vibes. So this was kind of cool. Got my experience there, learned my scales and chords and a couple pieces for 2 mallets, which was basically what they taught. But it really kind of fell my love for percussion, and then also seeing what a college student would probably do. And I'd loved all the classes that I did. So, and I applied there, 2 years later for college, and found out I was going to get a great scholarship, except scholarship there was still about $7,000 or $8,000 a year for Peabody. So I wound up going to Frostburg State University, which is in the armpit of Maryland, up in the western part. Great school. I was lucky in a way because we didn't have a full-time percussion teacher. So I was kind of a new freshman, and of course, coming from the experience I had with Peabody and with the, Bel Air High School was, about 4,000 students, so pretty large with 12th grade band, 11th grade band. So I was given the keys kind of, and I was section leader in the band and the marching band. So it was a good experience. Our percussion teacher was part-time. So he would travel once a week, basically a day and a half from WVU. So West Virginia University, he was the TA there, and would be there like, Monday, and then Tuesday would leave midday. So I got a chance, he would do the percussion methods class like one day. It was 2 day a week class, and I would teach the other. He asked me if I wanted to teach, so he gave me some things to teach. Halfway through the year, a group of us said, there's no percussion ensemble. Why don't we get together and play some stuff? Oh, that's cool. There was about 7 or 8 of us for the first semester. I went down to the local music store and picked 3 pieces out, like $2.99 each, and the music for percussion thing. And so we got together and we played a couple tunes. And first thing you know, we put on student recital. And it's like, wow, it's kind of neat. I was also working as a student worker. So I had a job in the music office and running copies or whatever. And the chair was very supportive of what we were doing percussion ensemble-wise. Everybody seemed to like that first concert. So he says, well, why don't you take some of your hours that you're doing work for your student worker and do that with percussion ensemble and just kind of continue that. So, wow, that's great, boy. And then eventually that second year, he says, we need to get that as a class so you can sign up and get credit for it. So what we did, and I don't think it's legal, you couldn't probably do it today, But, you know, I was getting paid by the music department as a student worker, directing the percussion ensemble. Of course, we had faculty supervision, which means he would come by every couple of weeks and look for 5 minutes, and they, sounds good, you guys are making progress. And then I do grades, I assign grades as an undergrad student. So that was a little strange.
Yeah.
That experience, I think that helped me get my first TA position at Ohio State with Jim Moore, and more experience there to LSU. I also got really inspired during my that first end of the first year. Our teacher at WPU invited us to go over and do a percussion ensemble concert to hear what they were doing. So I thought, okay, well, so after a band one day, the band ended like 4 to 5:30. We all hopped in a car and drove over the mountains because there's no used to be no interstate like there is now, and took like 2 hours to get there. And we showed up to this concert at 8 o'clock, and we were about 10 minutes late. Couldn't get in the door. It was so packed. And eventually, after about two pieces, some people would leave. So we sneak in the back and finally, you know, get into the second row in the back. So we heard majority of the first half. And then the second half at that time, Phil Fieni was the director. It was more popular music. So he and the students were doing a lot of arrangements. And but just to see, like, 1,500 people in one concert, you know, in a place to hear the percussion ensemble. It's like, wow. And of course, the standing ovation. And he would always do special, Phil Fieni would, he had the marching band come on and join the last piece, or the whatever ensemble, or you have the big drum set feature where, you know, eight people would do, you know, the combined solo. So it was real exciting. So we talked about trying to emulate that type thing. And I did my first percussion ensemble arrangement, you know, from listening to that concert. And that's a place that I really wanted to go to school for my master's. And I applied and found out that there wasn't a TA position open. And for me, that was important. So that last senior year in 77, I went to IU, which seemed to be, you know, kind of the place for a lot of percussion activity at the time. And George Gaber was a teacher, Indiana. So, you know, it's a nice trip. Me and the trumpet buddy from Frostburg went out there, and I did an audition, came back through Columbus, I-70 goes right through, stopped off and just said, why don't we, you know, grab something to eat? And we went to Wendy's and went to the music building at Ohio State, and there was a recital going on. So we kind of peeked our head in the door, and it wasn't a percussion recital, but I walked by, you know, walked down the building and saw the percussion studio and looked at programs and heard some people practicing. But it was like, wow, it seems like a lot of stuff going on. And I remembered I had this album, this LP called Concepts in Percussion that was done just a couple years before that. Ohio State University had the first recording of Saber Dance on it. Matter of fact, I had been in contact with Jim Moore about Saber Dance because I had the album and wrote a nice note. And so he actually had sent me a copy of that with manuscript before it was even published by Permis. So that kind of started the relationship. And then I had said, you know, I came by the building just accidentally, you know, I was on a trip to another school. And so he invited me to come out. He said, you know, I have a TA position open next year. Maybe you'd like to apply. So a couple of months later, you know, went out there and met him. And he was gracious. Matter of fact, even stayed at his house overnight and drove me around campus. Of course, took me to Ohio Stadium and watched, you know, team practice and whatnot. And I remember the interview. You know, I played a snare drum, a marimba solo, and a timpani solo. And it was a Sarone piece. Matter of fact, I think it was 32, one of my favorites that I've played. So after playing through it, he said, great, you know, why don't you take that one stick in your right hand and go ahead and conduct it for me. So I was like, oh, okay. So I... And after about, you know, the page, he wanted to see how I would do the patterns and whatnot. So it was kind of interesting. But, you know, the story was, you know, I got accepted into the program. And I was a TA along with Linda Pimentel, who was also a marimbist at the time. You know, I always said, you know, it was kind of her and Lee and Gordon Stout were like the big three, because she could sight read anything on the page. She was fantastic. And her desk was right next to mine in the studio, and then Dr. Moore after that. It was one of the best experiences. Those 2 years was just so much going on, so much activity. you know, to have that program with, you know, three band, or these four bands and two orchestras and five jazz bands, it's just, you know, world-class. I remember the orchestra, we did both the Rite of Spring and the Bartok Concerto for orchestra in the same quarter. Not the same concert, but so, I mean, it was, you know, great musicians and a learning experience. And when it came time to end of the second year to look at for doctorates, you know, I wanted to stay there. But Jim Moore, God bless him, said, you know, you need to go on and find some other place and get more information, more feedback. So, you know, I thank him for that. And they didn't have a DMA at that time. This is, you know, again, the late 70s. There was only like five schools in the country that offered a percussion DMA. I think you had 20 some, maybe 25, 26 that you could get a doctorate, but, you know, not the DMA. You know, the PhD, I could have done that. That's what Linda Pimentel was doing. So anyway, I did some research, and I remember a long weekend tour, like Thursday through Monday. You know, I went from Columbus. I went down to Miami. That was the place Fred Wickstrom was there in Miami. And, of course, Frederick Fennell, a conductor. Then went to LSU, you know, flew there. Texas, back to Columbus. I think the schools were Illinois would offer the doctorate. Tom Siwee, again, only had or no positions for a TA position. Miami, the Louisiana State, North Texas, you know, what, you know, used to be North Texas State University, now University of North Texas, and University of Texas. There may be one other, but I think those were the five schools. So, you know, the short story is, you know, LSU made me, John Rouse made me feel so welcome when I went there, and it was a day and a half, and, you know, played for him. He took me a tour of the town, and I remember just showing up at the airport, and his wife met me at the airport with a baby in arms, you know, like 6 months old, took me from the airport to the Centroplex Theater. The symphony was giving a concert, you know, he was playing timpani, and I got in on the second half. Went up to the stage afterwards, you know, introduced myself, and we went to his house. I remember she cooked dinner at like 11:30 at night, and we talked to like 2 or 3 in the morning, and it was just the connection was great. So when I got back to Columbus, it was like, boy, I hope I get, you know, even though the school was still young in its infancy as far as percussion goes, he was only about second or third year there. But just growing, he had come from University of Texas, had his DMA there. But it felt a connection. You know, I got other calls. Well, IU again, right. So I went to IU twice for an interview, and the doctorate was even different than the master's. Another sideline, you know, when I went to the audition on a Saturday, it was really weird because I didn't know any of the people there. I knew George Gaber was not in town because he was on a trip to China. He was doing some kind of a But anyway, there was five people in there, and there was like three questions. And after the third question, they were asking about my publications, which I'd already published some pieces, and the style of music or something that I like. Anyway, I just got, after 5 minutes, a little feeling of, I'm not sure I'm in the right place. You asked some composition questions, but I was here for percussion. And they looked at each other and said, ah, we thought you were going to be a composition major. So they hadn't scheduled percussion auditions that day. It was just what happened was my second IU experience. This is just 2 years after I'd been there before. So they called the percussion faculty, and two of them were able to come in that afternoon in about 45 minutes and hear me play. But it was just that experience is like, wow, they couldn't even figure out that. I sent my resume, and of course I had a couple publications already. So anyway, I picked LSU, and even though North Texas would have been another great choice, and Bob Shatromo was there, I just didn't have a good feeling. And you know, he called me up the last day when my application or my acceptance was due, and that's the first time I'd actually heard from him. Well, North Texas was, I think, the biggest or second biggest. Both of them, you know, had like 2,000, you know, music students, and I think there was probably over 100 percussion majors at that time. At North Texas. So it was a good trip and a good choice, I think, to go to LSU. I really got a great experience with John Rouse. He was one of the ultimate, consummate musicians. I remember my first lesson, because we were preparing for my audition recital. You know, for the doctorate, you have to do the the entrance, you know, exam and recital, and then your final exam, and then your dissertation after that. But we were working on the Creston, because I had done the Creston concertino before, and that was going to be my mallet piece. Went through the first movement, and a couple little pointers. He said, okay, did you bring the music with you? And I said, well, yeah, I think I do. Well, let's go ahead and run it once. So he grabs the piano music, sits down at the piano. Didn't start at the beginning. I'll just give you a couple bars lead in. And he's playing as close to the note for note to of that piano, which is like one of the, you know, worst accompaniments, you know, written. And we played through the first movement, and I'm thinking, I thought I was playing with a percussion teacher here, and this guy is like as good as any pianist that I've ever played with. Linda Pimentel was the same way. She almost did. As a matter of fact, she accompanied me on the Kirko when I was at Ohio State. But anyway, I learned so much about John Rausch as a musician, played great piano, but also found out that his undergrad was not a percussion major. He was a violin major. So, you know, being from Chicago, was in the Chicago Civic Orchestra, but also played timpani there. And when he was in Austin for Texas, University of Texas, he was in the Austin Symphony as a third or fourth percussionist. But when there wasn't the percussion part, he had his violin and would play second violin in the Austin Symphony. So the guy could play so many different instruments, including percussion. And I learned so much in those 5-6 years from him. And really between him and Jim Moore, both of them taught me more about English than I ever learned in my English classes besides. So like my dissertation, as I think it's pretty good, you know, wording and the articles that I've done for Percussive Notes, both he and Jim Moore taught me a lot about English, which was something I'd stayed away from as much as I could just because I did what I had to do.
Sure.
Yeah, well, Jim Moore, I got my first paper back from percussion lit class, and there was more red on that page than the black ink that I, you know, submitted. But, you know, when he turned it back, he says, you know, Dave, he says, this is some really good material here. This is, with a little revisions, you know, this might be publishable. And I said, really? Of course, he was editor of Percussive Notes at the time as well, and knew the fellow who did the Percussionist magazine. You know, there were two separate publications at that time. Percussionist Journal and then Percussive Notes. So that was my first publication. I went back and it was on the Kirko Concerto and revised some things and it's like, wow, I got paid for it. You know, you could actually get some money. So that's when I kind of, you know, found out another whole angle of things. So from Frostburg to Ohio State to LSU and then towards the end of my time there, it was like I finished my coursework, but the paper just got so big, you know, this dissertation was on the marimba and history, and I had to do more. So my assistantship was up. You couldn't do it, but I think 4 years. So then I became a band director. First it was going to be part-time, then it worked in full-time while I was finishing up as a student trying to finish the paper, which John Rausch helped me do that. And then the job came up. Well, there was another job before I got here to Moorhead, Minnesota. IUP. So Gary Olmsted was at Indiana University of Pennsylvania and needed a sabbatical. And he was one of those that every, 6-7 years, he applied with sabbatical and he got it. So you know, through Jim Moore, you know, we connected and I took a trip up there and did a little audition for him. So I did that the year before I got the job here, or 2 years before. And it was great. You know, Indiana, Pennsylvania, nice town. And that's pretty much, at that time, a utopia program. I still remember, you know, when I sat there the first time, figured out what music I was going to do for ensemble. I did part assignments. They had their own house. It was a percussion house. And you taught lessons, you know, in the, you know, basically was the living room and kitchen area, which was your office. And the rest, there's 3 stories. There were practice rooms with keyboards and timpani and. But I put out the music for whatever piece, like the next day or 2 days from then, with the part assignments. By the end of that first day, the music was gone. Heard people practicing, went into the first rehearsal. I still remember it was Neil DuPont, Celebration and Dance, or Chorale, Celebrate, which I'd heard it before, one of my favorites. We played through it almost the first time without stop. And then it was like, you know, I'm thinking to myself, what do I do now? I mean, they practiced, and it's like, that's really pretty good for the first time. Even at the other schools I was at, we never quite had that. So it was quite the year, and I enjoyed my time there immensely. But that was good experience. Went back to Baton Rouge, you know, taught elementary school that next year, and then the job, as we talked about a little while ago, opened up here, and kind of the rest is history, I guess, after that.
And you will get to hear part two of David's story next week. This week's rave is for the protesters and all of those who support them. I'm not including myself in this rave to be fair to those who are really doing it all the time. If you've been reading up about what's been going on with the protests since they were sparked by the deaths of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd, you are perhaps aware that protests, memorials, hearings, calls for boycotts, firings, removals in various ways of the problematic statues that we're seeing, all of these are occurring at a very fast pace. And who should we thank for this? The protesters on the front line, particularly those in the African American community who have borne the brunt of this. If you've read, if you've listened, particularly in light of last week's episode, the reason that these protests have been going on is primarily due to members of various African American communities putting themselves on the line on a daily basis. They've been the heroes and the catalysts for change that we hope can come about. And it's the African Americans who are making it a more inclusive situation for all to attend, to be a part of the solution, and to, if we're being honest, have a majority white population in the United States come to real terms with the systems of racism that have been here since well before the founding of the nation. Hopefully, this can all lead to a sustained movement and make this a country that all Americans can be proud of all of the time. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast and Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can always find all of the episodes and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes, as well as on Spotify. The podcast is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and many other podcast platforms. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast, and I've been using that page to post more links as the time has gone on. You can find me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I'll see you next week for part two of my conversation with David Eiler. Until then.